Утвержден состав нового правительства России.
Итак, вот новые лица в российском правительстве.
В новом правительстве Дмитрия Медведева остался...
Кабинет министров претерпел значительные изменения.
Шувалов Игорь Иванович. Сурков Владислав Юрьевич.
It was musical chairs in the Kremlin this week. First, on Monday, Vladimir Putin announced a new cabinet in which three quarters of the ministers were replaced. Old war horses like energy czar Igor Sechin and interior minister Rashid Nurgaliyev were out. Reformers like economist Arkady Dvorkovich and businessman Mikhail Abuizov were in. So a big change, right? Well, not so fast. A day later, we learned that Putin named seven of the deposed ministers to Kremlin posts, including the deeply unpopular Nurgaliyev, who will be deputy secretary of the Security Council. Sechin, as expected, also landed on his feet as CEO of the state oil giant Rosneft, a post he lost during the presidency of Dmitry Medvedev. So the more things seem to change, the more they end up staying the same. The same two dozen or so insiders, the so-called Collective Putin, still appear to be calling the shots behind the scenes. Russia's permanent elite. Can they preserve the status quo in a hypercharged environment with a re-energized civil society demanding change? Hello and welcome to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. My regular co-host, Kirill Coburn, is off this week, visiting his hometown of Nizhny Novgorod, but we'll be back for the next podcast, no doubt with some cool stories and, as usual, keen insights. But the good news is, filling in for Kirill and joining us from New York thanks to the amazing magic of Skype technology is veteran Russia watcher Mark Galliotti, somebody Power Vertical fans should be familiar with. But for those who aren't, Mark is a professor of global affairs at New York University and the author of one of my favorite Russia blogs, In Moscow's Shadows. He's also the author and editor of numerous books on Russia and writes the regular Moscow news column, Siloviks and Scoundrels. Welcome, Mark. Thanks for joining us today, and I hope I didn't leave anything out of your impressive resume there.
Not at all. However old being called a veteran Russia watcher makes me feel.
Well, we're all getting older. Both a formal and informal governance exists in all societies, even democratic ones, where unaccountable deals are often cut behind the scenes, away from the prying eyes of the public and the media. But when those informal arrangements become institutionalized and the formal institutions of government, like parliament and the cabinet, become mere window dressing in political theater for public consumption, this is something else entirely. During Putin's rule, Russia appears to be developing what political scientists call a deep state, a permanent super elite that decides policy, sets the rules of the political game and the parameters of legitimate debate, as well as deciding who is allowed to formally rule. To get the ball rolling, Mark, do you think this is what we see happening in Russia? And if so, what are the implications?
Yeah, I think actually the whole model of a deep state is actually quite a compelling one to try and understand quite how Russia works these days. And I think really there are four key implications that it's worth looking at very briefly. I mean, one is that politics, therefore, always becomes personalized, and particularly it's about people's relationship to Putin, but it's also about people's personal relationships with each other. And again, this is nothing that we haven't seen in Moscow for years, decades, centuries. Secondly, it's clearly it's non-transparent. And although it's always problematic to find myself agreeing with communist leader Zyuganov, I mean, I think he's right to say that we have an official cabinet under Medvedev and then a real cabinet under Putin. And exactly the relationships between the two are sort of very hard for us to tease out.
And there seems to be some crossover among the two, or between the two.
Yeah, I mean, I think it illustrates the fact that, in fact, the cabinet isn't an irrelevance. I think it's more that precisely because all these relationships are personalized, in some ways it doesn't really matter where people are sitting. Security Council, cabinet, Rosneft, head office. The actual venue is pretty much a secondary issue.
So is this, and as you've put it, is this a diffuse court of Tsar Vladimir? Or is this genuinely a collective, cohesive Putin, almost like a Politburo, if you will?
To be honest, I think it's probably closer to the court than the Politburo. I mean, there's problems with that. I mean, obviously, Putin doesn't set every angle of policy or whatever, but he very much has created a system in which he is the, to use the George Bushism, the decider. Any sort of key policy measures have to be blessed by him, and therefore the battle for his sanction is the key one. As I said, I mean, the others are powerful figures. They all have their own portfolios, their own responsibilities and their own agendas. But when it comes down to it, it all has to go to the court.
And another aspect of the deep state that I wanted to discuss here, because this concept really came into being when discussing modern Turkey, right? And the deep state was this permanent cabal of military military officers and retired military officers who just made sure that the parameters of debate didn't go into any dangerous directions, be it to the left or be it in an Islamic direction. And they would depose governments as they saw fit. This all worked up until Erdogan came into power. But another feature of that was that there was turnover, that you could retire in a dignified way, that it wasn't the same set of people. The fact that a deep state existed did not mean that it was the same people occupying the same posts. And the other aspect of the Turkish deep state is that elections went on relatively free and fairly. People were elected and served their terms, retired, and went on. Business went on. Well, real decisions were made by the deep state, or the parameters were set by the deep state. I thought this was where Russia was going if you talked to me a year ago, for example, or if you read the blog a year ago, right? I thought this was where Russia was going, and this is why one of the reasons I thought that Medvedev would serve a second term and that Putin was institutionalizing a deep state in which, for the time being, he was the decider, as you put it, but that there would be other deciders that would come into the game. They don't seem to have been that clever, have they? Because that might have been a much more stable arrangement than what we are seeing now if the ultimate goal was to keep this elite into power. What would you say to that?
Yeah, and I think there's really two factors for this. I mean, I agree with you entirely. But I mean, of course, the key thing was precisely the deep state stayed deep. The interesting thing about Russia is that you have a deep state, but on the other hand, as it were, a member of that deep state who is also president or, you know, hyper prime minister previously. And in that case, I mean, the first issue is that it came down to Putin's choice. There's very little reason to believe that if he had been willing to let Medvedev continue for another term, suddenly things would have gone bad for him and those around him or anything like that. It probably would have been a relatively stable continuation of the tandem. But he just didn't seem willing to actually let go.
It might have been even better for them. They might not have been facing what they're facing now if they went ahead with that, because the first thing that really sparked the anger wasn't the allegations of falsification in the State Duma election in December. It was that decision in September at the United Russia Congress when they just said, OK, we're going to switch jobs and you're going to like it.
This is it. But that's the whole point. I mean, we can look at what would have made sense. And it's clear that Putin made a phenomenal blunder there. For whatever reason, he just wasn't willing to let go. Maybe it's because he felt he had to be in the limelight. Maybe it's because he had qualms about whether or not Medvedev could handle the job. We don't really know. Someday, maybe it'll emerge. But for the moment, it is clear that he made a colossal blunder by, again, really dragging the deep state into public view. The deep state worked when everyone sort of roughed that it was existing, if you look at Turkey or whatever. But nonetheless, that it was willing to operate behind a carapace, a facade of politicians. Putin made the presence of the deep state so clear, he rubbed it in Russian society's nose, and that was a big mistake.
Do you think, I mean, there's been some theories about why he did this. One of them was that Russia's the kind of country where the paper flow really matters, and therefore it matters who the president is. Do you think that makes sense?
Well, maybe or maybe not. I mean, I think, again, in some ways, we're trying to find more rationality than I suspect actually was behind the process. Yes, of course, the way the system is currently structured, whoever is sitting behind the big desk in the Kremlin matters, as you say, the paper flow matters. But first of all, I don't think it would have been impossible to have tweaked the system to make it a little bit more collective, a little bit more constraints upon the executive in the interest of the deep state. But the second point is that we've seen that it can work. We've seen, in its own way, I wouldn't exactly want to hold up the Medvedev era as a paragon of governance. But nonetheless, from the point of view of the deep state, they could work perfectly well while having a front man. I don't think anything had changed. I think it's actually just that Putin, seeing his own, maybe his place in history or whatever, sort of being sort of written out in due course, felt he had to return. He does have this sense he is the only person who can handle Russia. And therefore, I think his ego got in the way of his common sense.
So this is an issue of arrogance.
Absolutely. I mean, I think this is it. And historically, I think this will prove to be one of the key issues. And again, that leads to the second key challenge of the deep state is precisely because of that decision, of the public anger as a result of that, that therefore now the elite faces a period of crisis. And again, in that case, when you feel challenged on the streets, the temptation of the deep state is actually to tighten its grip. And so in a way, I think this becomes a sort of a vicious circle. That actually it will feel, because it feels more assailed, it therefore will feel it has to be more dominant over the political system.
And do you think this will be a kind of a harbinger of a kind of authoritarian period, or is this what's going to deep six the deep state, so to speak?
Well, I mean, it's interesting to think of the second part of that. I mean, what's going to happen to the deep state? It relies on, frankly, being able to work through a relatively functioning political system that is willing to sort of accept the tugs and pushes from their various levers. When we talk about an authoritarian regime that's coming, or an authoritarian sort of swing, again, this doesn't necessarily mean troops on the streets or anything like that, but I certainly think that the initial prospect that in fact there will be some movement in the Kremlin that could and would reach out to elements of civil society that was unhappy and reach some kind of deal with them. I think we're seeing those prospects diminish. I think there is that sense that they're just going to hunker down and hope that they can actually weather this current storm.
Who do you see as the players in this collective Putin, in this deep state? I mean, you talk to different analysts, you get different names popping up. I mean, the ones that I see most often are, of course, Putin and Medvedev and Sechin, Sergei Ivanov, the Kremlin chief of staff, Sergei Naryshkin, the Duma speaker, Moscow Mayor Sobyanin, a new member, and then businessmen like Yuri Kovalchuk, who is often called Putin's personal banker, and Gennady Timchenko, who doesn't even live in Russia, Roman Abramovich, and then there's some defectors, some former members of this inner circle, like ex-finance minister Alexei Kudrin, who remains personally close to Putin, but it's hard to say he's in the ruling circle right now, and as well as Surkov, who is a prominent member of the ruling circle, but seems to have been banished. Do you think this is what we see in the inner core group? I mean, it's people tend to say there's about a dozen or so in this inner core group, and then maybe another two dozen that are kind of on the periphery of it. Would you name or put in or take out any names there?
No, I mean, I think you've given a pretty good summary of the key movers and shakers. But I think I'm always slightly concerned about attempts to actually bring it down to key names, because in a way, what makes these people members of the inner circle? Now, in some cases, it's primarily a personal relationship with Putin. In other cases, though, it's actually because they are representatives of wider interests. Let's take, for example, someone like Sergei Ivanov. Yes, he's important because Putin will listen to him. But he's also important because there's a whole strand of other, you know, often quite sort of Silovik, associated interest groups that talk to him, for whom he can, as it were, sometimes be a representative. I mean, this is the interesting thing about a deep state, is that precisely it acts not so much as just simply how a cabal of individuals can govern a state, then you're talking oligarchy. Instead, it's actually as certain sectional interests manage to assert power far greater than the constitution suggests. I mean, we're here in this sort of territory of what Richard Sakwa calls the sort of dual state in his Crisis of Russian Democracy. He creates this compelling example of a constitutional mm-hmm. state struggling against an administrative regime. I think it's more that these are all representatives of different aspects of the administrative regime. Looking to see how they can control the constitutional state.
So if you look at somebody like Sechin, for example, he's got multiple levers there. One of his long association with Putin, his connection to the GRU, as well as his command of the energy sector. If you look at somebody like Sobyanin, well, the only reason he's in there is because he was mayor of Moscow. right? And he basically runs the capital. And mayors, especially Moscow mayors, tend to be able to run the capital like a personal fiefdom. So there's several of these different interlocking kind of spheres of influence there. What are some of the other ones you would kind of identify?
Well, I mean, I think in some ways it's interesting to actually unpick who might be around and associated with Medvedev. I mean, I've been as guilty as anyone else of actually regarding him as a faintly pathetic figure, simply the puppet through whom Putin associates himself with power. But I mean, I think it's interesting if we look at some of the new figures coming up. I mean, people like Dvorkovich, mm-hmm. who again, they don't actually have the personal connectivity. They don't necessarily have quite such an obvious institutional block. But nonetheless, they are, as it were, building, I think, for themselves a role within the dual state. You know, even someone like, I mean, for God's sake, Nurgaliyev, interior minister, who was frankly a very poor interior minister.
To say the least.
Absolutely. I know we'll be talking more about the sort of Siloviki later. But nonetheless, I mean, there is that sense that he carries with himself a certain kind of association of people, which is one of the reasons why he's been given a sort of a new place within the Security Council. So in some ways, I think what's particularly interesting is if we can look at a slightly sort of a peripheral wannabe deep state circle. Rogozin is another interesting figure who, on the one hand, is definitely something of a political outsider. But nonetheless, you know, he's now, you know, clearly charged with mastering the defense industry sector.
Mm-hmm.
He's, you know, I would say, one of the more characterful deputy prime ministers we have within this cabinet.
Yes.
We wouldn't describe him, as I think, really as a member of Putin's inner circle. But nonetheless, he's now someone who, as it were, comes with a dowry of power and connections. And therefore, there is an interest from, as it were, that deep state circle to make sure that they have him on board.
Along those lines, I recently read a piece in the Russian media. I confess I forget which publication it was in, which argued that Rogozin was trying to build his own clan in the inner circle, and then that was going to be able to, you know, maybe not rival the Sechen clan, but at least sit in the same room with it.
Exactly. And I think that's an interesting sign, because again, if we look at the sort of characteristic Turkish deep state, it was a pretty stable and static organization. Yes, people rose and fell, but nonetheless, the basic structures were quite solid. Now we see a deep state that is going through quite a lot of subterranean turmoil, mm-hmm. as tectonic plates grind against one another. The very notion of, I think Rogozin is trying to build his own power base. The very notion of people, as it were, trying to create new clans, to use that particular language, I think suggests something about actually sort of the element to which this deep state is in crisis.
Now, this may have been happening in the Turkish deep state, but it was really kept under the carpet. It didn't bubble into public discourse. And that is, as you pointed out, is a key difference. Another interesting thing we're seeing here, and I alluded to it, and I've written about it on the blog recently, is the defectors from the deep state. Kudrin, for example. I mean, where does he figure in this? Where does Surkov figure in this? Because they were in the inner circle, and now it's hard to say that they are in the inner circle. None of them are too far from where power lies. But how do people like that, very skilled managers, who, and again, this is bringing up the shareholder-manager dichotomy that I want to talk about a little bit as well, but where do you see people like Kudrin and Surkov figuring into this mix?
Well, there you've got two different models, which I think are both worth dwelling on for a moment. I mean, in Surkov's case, he fell from grace, but Lucifer was welcomed back into heaven. you know, he is now Medvedev's man. So on one level, he's clearly back into the sort of the central discussion. But nonetheless, he has an interesting new role. And I think this is going to be one of the challenges, is actually how Surkov, who is, after all, used to basically running the show as it comes to power's relationship with society, copes with being sort of just part of the prime ministerial entourage. But nonetheless, at least on one level, at least he's back in. Kudrin, though, actually seems to have chosen not to. I mean, I'm sure that it's clear that if he had wanted to be in some way or other associated with the new government, he would have been in. But nonetheless, he chose not to. And in fact, he's actually becoming increasingly critical. There's this new report that's come out from a Russian think tank with whom he's associated that actually posts posits some very, very negative scenarios for Russia and talks about political crisis and so forth.
Well, he's talking about what will happen.
Doesn't want.
Yeah, no, he's sorry to interrupt you. What the report seems to be saying is that in this political environment, if the kind of Greek contagion spreads to Russia, so to speak, then it is going to be an absolutely explosive situation. My take on Kudrin is that he's kind of trying to turn himself into a prime minister in waiting who's saying, listen, if you guys ever want to come to your senses and get serious about reform, I'm here. But until then, I'm going to do my own thing, secure in the understanding that I, with my personal relationship with Putin, what's unsaid is makes me untouchable. Would you say that pretty much sums up Kudrin's position right now?
Well, yes, but I think the type of prime minister he's willing to be, I mean, you say come to your senses. He's not simply saying, look, I'm better than Medvedev, which I think is probably a fair comment.
Right.
I think it's more that what he's saying is, if you want me as prime minister, and I would be a good prime minister, you will also have to accept that I will come with a certain political agenda that you're going to have to swallow at the same time. I mean, I think this is the interesting thing, that precisely when he first split, I think probably if Putin had gone to him and said, yeah, fair point, you're right, I know I promised the prime minister's position to Medvedev, but you'll be better, I'll give it to you, I think he would have been assimilated without too much problem. I think precisely from being an outsider, I think actually his position has toughened, and I think maybe his perspective has shifted. And therefore, I think he's actually making it clear that it would be a different kind of government and a different kind of prime ministerial role if he was going to be brought in. So again, on this level, yes, he's touting for business. He's making it clear that he's available. But on the other hand, he's also showing the political price tag that will be associated with his role.
Now, segueing back to the deep state on Kudrin, do you think his agenda, and this is, I'm trying to figure this out, I have no idea whether this is what the case is here, but do you think that Kudrin is, his agenda is the end of the deep state in a more democratic, transparent system? Or do you think he wants to just a little bit more open of a deep state with him as prime minister or something like that? Do you see what I mean? What is he for real or not? I guess is from the perspective of democratic reform.
I think that he is implicitly rather than explicitly opposed to the deep state. By which I mean, we've had no real evidence in the past that he had any problem with the way that Russian politics was run.
Right.
Maybe because precisely he was in the innermost circle and therefore was one of its beneficiaries. But on the other hand, I mean, I think it's clear that the kind of reforms that Kudrin thinks that Russia needs, I mean, I think he's right, particularly economic reforms, will bring with them a far greater transparency, a need to actually assert the rule of law over economics and not have sort of the kind of raiding that is still so much a feature, which will automatically, bit by bit, erode the power of the deep state, erode its freedom of maneuver, and erode the economic basis of its power. So, I mean, I think that Kudrin may not be targeting the deep state, but Kudrinist reforms would definitely be problematic for that structure.
And he's smart enough to understand that. Now, Surkov is a different case here, and he's another one. Also, I'm not sure if he's had an epiphany or not, but he became more and more outspoken for the need for political reform. But in the case of Surkov, I think it was to preserve the existing arrangements. He said, if you want to keep this arrangement, this what we're calling the deep state, to continue on, it needs to at least give a little bit more of an appearance of being open. Since Surkov has been on the outs, it seems to me, and also before him, Gleb Pavlovsky, who is another talented political manager who worked in the Kremlin, the Kremlin seems to have been making a lot of mistakes. Surkov is a very, very, very talented individual. He was very good at what he did. Volodin is, and Kirill and I talked about this in the last podcast, is a little bit more clumsy, if you will, or crude in his methods, where Surkov was good at subterfuge and charming his opponents and getting a result without hitting you over the head with a sledgehammer. The Kremlin seems to be a little bit more heavy-handed now. Are they missing Surkov? And the same question that I had about Kudrin, what's Surkov's agenda?
Well, to start with Surkov's agenda, I agree. I think that essentially he is someone who believes that the system, the essence of the system can and should be retained. But precisely, he's a smart conservative. He realizes that often the best way to actually preserve the status quo, in essence, is to make changes in, you know, or make reforms, which will, if nothing else, co-opt forces that otherwise will be against the system. That said, I'm not convinced that in the long term, Surkov is right. The thing about Surkov, and I've often felt this, he's very, very clever. In some ways, I think he's sometimes too clever for his own good. he seems to be a great, great believer that there's always some maneuver. There's always some way you can get around anything by some sort of cute political technologies. I do think that Russia actually is coming at a pretty much a sort of a one of these kind of critical junctures. I think it's very hard to see how a kind of a Surkovian method could co-opt enough of the forces. You know, even if, let's say, one could find ways in which the Navalny's of this world could somehow be co-opted, and I don't think there's any great reason to think that is the case. But even if, you know, Surkov, I'm sure he's smarter than me, I'm sure he can think of something to do that. But that would not deal with the essential socioeconomic pressures which are actually leading to the current protest movement. It's not just simply about individuals. And in that respect, I mean, although Volodin is definitely graceless and clumsy in his tactics, and would seem to be making mistakes, in some ways, I think he's right. In some ways, I think the whole point is actually that I don't believe there is any way to reconcile the growing political realities of Russia on the ground with the preservation of the deep state. Now, I hope it'll never come to this, but I mean, I think that it may well be the situation where the deep state will actually have to, not now, not today, not in the next 12 months, but within the course of the first, maybe last, Putin presidency, is to decide that it actually needs to really clamp down. I don't think the Surkovian tactics in the long term would work.
So we're moving towards a decisive battle between the power vertical and the power horizontal, so to speak.
I think so. And I think, again, in this, I think I'd echo what Kirill said in your last podcast, that actually, you know, a couple of months ago, it was easy to, or not easy, but possible to see what was happening as something that was manageable and as it were, wasn't necessarily going to lead to major change. But I think actually the way that the protest movement has moved from being simply a protest movement into actually a sort of both a much more diffuse social protest in Moscow, but also the beginnings of more kind of measured political approaches being used out in the provinces, out in cities, we've seen it in mayoral elections and so forth, but how people can actually talk to the masses and tell the masses that there are good political reasons why they want this regime to change. It means for me, I think that bit by bit, we are actually leading to one of those key crunch moments.
And as we head to one of those crunch moments, and before we move on to the Siloviki, I wanted to get your thoughts on the dichotomy I've been writing about on the blog, Kirill and I discussed in the podcast last week, and that is this dichotomy between the managers and the shareholders inside the inner circle, inside the collective Putin, inside the deep state. The shareholders have a stake in the system and are therefore very conservative. They tend to overlap with the Siloviki, by the way. The managers are people with specific skills, people like Kudrin and Surkov, who have been hired by the shareholders and have been brought into the ruling circle because they can do certain things like manage the political system and relationship between the state and the society, or manage the financial, the macroeconomics and the finances. The managers seem to understand that reform is necessary because of their expertise. Mm-hmm. The shareholders, as I said, are worried about losing what they have in the event of any change. This seems like an impossible conflict to reconcile. What do you see here? Or do you just get better managers that are more pliant? I don't know. Or more obedient managers?
Unfortunately, that rarely means better. I mean, I think it's true. What we have is power is largely in the hands of these shareholders. And I think it's a useful sort of model to use. And because they suddenly got worried, they got worried about everything from macroeconomics to politics, they have sacked and reprimanded their managers. But of course, they're not really able or willing to actually manage themselves. So what, I mean, if you look at the cabinet, in many cases, what they've simply done is they've simply promoted the deputies. Mm-hmm. The problem is exactly that the shareholders regard the role of the managers as simply to be the executors of their will. Mm-hmm. And as long as they do that, and as long as they're not politically problematic, then they're sort of happy. But when the managers turn around and say, look, you know, things are going to be going wrong, we need to do something more substantial, and the shareholders turn around and then just simply slap down the managers or sack them, the problem is that you actually get a situation in which they are increasingly insulating themselves from reality. And again, here, because Kirill's not here, we can play historical analogies for a moment. But this is the classic late Soviet model.
Yes, yes,
it is. You actually had a Politburo full of people who were increasingly out of touch with the reality. You had the irony of as it were, the managerial elite within the KGB of all places, trying to actually say, for heaven's sake, this isn't working. But the shareholders were much more happy just to sit back and just simply say, well, if it's not working, it's because the right people aren't in place to run the system for us, or the sort of the detail of policy in how it's enacted isn't quite right, rather than ever thinking, well, maybe the direction we're trying to take this country in isn't working. So I think this is the problem. The shareholders must listen to the managers, and the evidence at the moment is that they don't.
And that's, I mean, if for the preservation of the system, that's not a good sign. If you're hoping the system will change, that might be a good sign. And by the way, actually, Kirill himself brought up the similar analogy, even though he hates historical analogies in the last podcast. In a few moments, we're going to turn to a topic that Mark is more than qualified to weigh in on, and that is, how are the fabled Siloviki faring under Putin 2.0? I'd like to remind you that you are listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. With me via Skype is special guest Mark Galeotti, professor of global affairs at New York University and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows and the Moscow news column Siloviks and Scoundrels. Kirill Coburn will be back next week. I'd also like to remind you that you can read the Power Vertical blog at rferl.org. You can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes, and you can follow us on Twitter at Power Vertical.
Людям не нужны кабинетные генералы.
People don't need armchair generals and reports. People need safety and tranquility. This is the best indicator of the quality of police work. And you know my principle, personal responsibility for police officers and their supervisors. This isn't a whim, but an unconditional aspect of police work.
That was new Interior Minister Vladimir Kolkoltsev speaking this week after his appointment, which you characterize in your blog and on Twitter this week, Mark, as a safe, cautious choice. There were nevertheless some small ripples in Siloviki land this week, with Kolkoltsev replacing Nurgaliyev as Interior Minister, and with Security Service veteran Igor Sechin out of a formal government post for the first time in a decade when he took over as CEO of Rosneft. Mark, we often speak about the Siloviki and the security service veterans surrounding Putin as if they were a united and coherent group or clan. But that really isn't the case, is it? Could you outline for our listeners some of the key subclans and how you see them faring going forward in the new Putin administration?
No, you know, I think it's interesting precisely that actually the Siloviki are increasingly divided. And instead of starting with subclans, I mean, I think really there's five, and I'll be very brief, five ways in which they're fractured. I mean, there's institutional interests, let's say the FSB competing against the Interior Ministry. Then there's specific factions, these subclans. So, for example, we see the FSB and the Investigations Committee, backed by Petrushev at the Security Council, often competing against the MVD. Then there's the third distinction, which is center versus periphery. If you're out in the regions, you have a very, very different perspective from the Muscovite Siloviki elite. There's a more broad division between, I think, the military and pretty much everyone else. And then finally, there's actually, I think, a great and growing gulf between the top and the bottom, by which I mean not, as it were, the ordinary conscripts or cops necessarily, but the more junior officer corps, who tend to be much more, I think, change, if not necessarily reform-minded, and the senior elite, who are much more interested in protecting their positions and institutional interests.
So how do you see this, all of this playing out? As we go forward, do you see any conflicts between or among these groups?
Yeah, I mean, I think we've always seen political conflicts between various interests within the Siloviki. You know, the FSB, which has been seeking to more or less kind of recreate the old KGB in terms of a sort of a single structure that controls all elements of internal and external security. We've often seen the military struggling for budgets against others and so forth. So that's no different from, frankly, any society. What I think is interesting is actually we're coming closer, I feel, to that sort of potential tipping point in which, actually, as it were, players within the Siloviki, who are, after all sort of individual and institutional political entrepreneurs in their own right, begin to actually think, well, okay, where do my long-term interests lie? Is it in trying to maintain the status quo, or is it actually in beginning to identify ourselves as some kind of structure outside of the deep state? You know, we can see, for example, that within the FSB and within the police force, there are people, particularly on regional commands, who are sometimes expressing views that are contrary to the orders coming out of Moscow, in a way that actually once upon a time would have been very unlikely and very problematic. So, I mean, I think what we're actually seeing is the building up of tensions along these fault lines within the Siloviki. Now, if the political and economic system stabilizes, then I think those tensions will subside. People who are on the wrong side are going to get sort of squeezed out, but all will be worked out. But if we, and I think it's probably likely, if we actually posit a future in which the tensions just simply increase, then I think actually we are going to begin to see real pressures on the sort of the Silovik consensus.
And where do you think that can go? I mean, what would this look like in practice?
Well, on a very granular level, it'll look like, for example, local police commands not being keen to deploy police against protesters. Mm-hmm. I mean, we've after all already saw that a few years back
over in Vladivostok.
And that really sent a shockwave through the interior ministry structure. And they're desperately trying now to re-centralize the police force, make sure that all budgets are handled centrally and so forth. But to be perfectly honest, they're not having a great deal of success. And part of that is exactly that people who have had nice, cushy berths in Moscow do not want to go out to the provinces for more than at most a year to punch their card. So actually what we're seeing is a very, very clear differentiation between, as it were, the Moscow police elite, well, which I'll include St. Petersburg, and the regional police elite. So, I mean, I think there is a still, you know, one way in which it's going to emerge is precisely when we start seeing police being ill-willing to act as stormtroopers. The second point is actually what's going to happen within the military. I mean, here we have an irony that we have a Minister of Defense who's not a career soldier, actually been surprisingly successful in terms of bringing reform to the system, is roundly despised by the majority of his high command, precisely because of his various reforms. But on the other hand, actually is much more in line with the more junior members of the officer corps, people who are actually, again, people who are, as it were, more like managers than shareholders within the defense ministry structure. Now, I think what might happen is we might see the sort of the current pressures against the interior, the defense minister, again, bubbling much more sort of strongly into the surface. We could actually see, for example, the high command really trying to unite against him and his chief of the general staff. In a way that we haven't yet seen. We've seen kind of leaks and grumbles, that kind of thing, but we haven't actually seen a sort of, as it were, a formal démarche in which they try and get rid of him. That kind of thing would all demonstrate the rise of the tensions within the system.
And he is nearly untouchable because of he's close with Putin, and it would be very, wouldn't a démarche be very difficult there?
Serdyukov?
Yeah.
I'm actually, firstly, I was encouraged by the fact that he kept his position because he is, for me, a quintessential manager. You know, he identifies a problem and he's willing to try and fix it, you know, in the interests of the overall political system. I don't think he has a great political constituency at the court of Tsar Vladimir. I think he's held on precisely because he has been able to do something that successive defense ministers have failed to do. And particularly following Georgia, in which, of course, the Russians won, they couldn't help that. But on the other hand, they won much less convincingly, easily, and cheaply than they should. For that reason, I think that there is a perception that the kind of reforms he's bringing out will actually create much more usable military capacities. So he's very much there on a kind of technocratic legitimization. He stays in place so long as he's not too politically costly, mm-hmm. and he's able to do his job. But I think on the other hand, if either it looked as if military reform under him was stalling, which is not impossible, or he became too politically expensive to keep in place, I think he'd be sacked without a moment's hesitation.
Okay. I had always seen him as a little bit more untouchable than that, but you know a lot more about this than I do. I wanted to return to the MVDIF for a minute in this what happened in Vladivostok back in 2008. Just for listeners who are not familiar with this, there was a protest of it was over the tariffs on automobiles, if I remember correctly. Mm-hmm. And there were a series of protests out in Vladivostok, and the order came from Moscow to put this down, and the local police chief said no. We're not going to do this. We're not going to put this down. This is organic. It grew up. It would just be explosive to try to put this down. And they flew in special Amman troops from the Moscow Oblast to do the job. And this, to me, this was actually the very first signal of a crack in the power vertical. Right. It was an mm-hmm. order that went out from Moscow to the province. It's something. It doesn't get much more basic than this. Right. The order goes out from Moscow to a police force in the provinces to put down a protest, and the police say no, and they have to fly in special Oman troops from Moscow to do it. And this told me, wow, the power vertical isn't as tight as we thought it was. It also points to something else, is that the Siloviki are not always the hardliners we make them out to be. Do you mm-hmm. see parts of the Siloviki ending up supporting people like Navalny to put a human face on it at the end of the day?
Yeah, I agree entirely. I mean, I think the Siloviki, I mean, they certainly share a relatively nationalist agenda, but nationalist does not have to mean conservative. Quite the opposite. Often nationalist means reformist and modernizing. And I think particularly if we're not talking about the absolute sort of, the very tops, the generals and so forth, I think there is actually quite a strong constituency for some kind of change. Doesn't necessarily mean liberal, though there are people within the police and even the security apparatus who definitely, I think, I would regard as relatively liberal, who manage to kind of reconcile what they do in the public interest with how they also end up being used as tools of repression. But more broadly, these are the people who will tend to be at the front line. Just as I've mentioned, it was the KGB that was the sort of key engine of reform mm-hmm. In late Soviet times, because A, they were the ones who really knew what was going on, and B, they knew full well that if things did explode, they would be the ones who'd have to deal with it. So too, I think the thing about the Siloviki is that what they do has direct and often personal impact. I think if we had to kind of talk about the Siloviki as a whole, however much of a caricature it is, I think they are much more sort of nationalist technocrats. Mm. Under Putin's first term in office, and also under Medvedev, it was certainly possible to actually see Putin as being the right leader for the country, particularly when you think of the 1990s. Increasingly, though, and I'm encountering it from conversations that I'm having, is that I think there are people who, from a nationalist and a patriotic perspective, are feeling that actually some kind of substantial reform is needed. And by reform, I don't mean a crackdown. I mean some kind of liberalization. Plus also, there's a really basic point that police officers, for example, and FSB, but particularly police officers, are fully aware of the terribly low esteem in which they're held in society. No one likes being derided and despised. And I think that also has an impact on them wanting to feel a greater sort of community. Now, the problem is obviously that there are also practical interests at work. Let's say a Navalny or some further generation political leader turned around and said, look, I'm willing to offer an amnesty. The day we come into power, we will consider as year zero. We won't ask too much about where your money came from before then. We won't dig too deeply in what you did before then, just as long as you're good boys and girls now. My suspicion is actually that would be really quite a compelling offer for a lot of people within the Silovik elite. Again, not the very, very top people, but you know, even up to, as it were, the more junior generals who certainly have ample economic assets that they want to protect. So again, I mean, I think this idea that we don't often tend to think of automatically as the Siloviki as completely and utterly committed to the preservation of the status quo, I think really we actually have to question that. And I think we're now going to see a situation in which there are some Siloviki who are, and many Siloviki and certainly Siloviki interests that aren't.
Mm-hmm. And on that note, I'm going to have to say there's going to be plenty to keep us both in work for a lot of time into the future, Mark. Unfortunately, that's all we have time for today. I'd like to remind you that you have been listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. With me from New York via Skype has been special guest Mark Galeotti, professor of global affairs at New York University and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows and of the Moscow News column Siloviks and Scoundrels. Kirill Coburn will be back next week. I'd also like to remind you that you can read the Power Vertical blog at rferl.org. You can also subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes and follow us on Twitter at Power Vertical. See you again next week. And as always, I now leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.